Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Hi, this is John Gold, and I am your guest host for this segment of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, so we can commemorate the 10th anniversary of Camp Casey. Before we begin, I want to say that out of all of the events that have taken place since 9/11, Camp Casey is the one event I wish I could have been at. I was definitely there in spirit. So here I am with Cindy Sheehan. How are you doing today, Cindy?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you, John Gold, for doing this, but I was thinking for this week, who could I interview to talk about Camp Casey? And then I thought, well, who's the best person to talk about Camp Casey than me? So I thought that I would ask you to interview me about it.
Well, thank you very much. I followed it every day at the time. I wish I could have been there. I was watching Brad blog and, you know, everything that was happening. So I tried to be as supportive as possible. All right, so we're going to get right into the questions. Why don't you tell us about some of the activism you took part in prior to Camp Casey?
Well, of course, Camp Casey, and I think we're going to talk about this, was named after my son, Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq on April 4th, 2004. And then, of course, this is the 10th anniversary of Camp Casey. So that happened on August 6, 2005. So it was about 18 months after, 16 months after Casey was killed. So right after Casey was killed, I started to try and network with people who had lost their children in the war or whose children had been killed in the illegal and immoral wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I got hooked up with an organization called Military Families Speak Out, which didn't really have members whose children had died. But anyway, I started doing work with Military Families Speak Out, which put me in contact with other family members of soldiers who were killed in Iraq, because just like right at that time Casey was killed, more and more U.S. military were being killed. It's like really the start, April 4th, 2004 was really the start of the mass insurgency against the U.S. occupation in Iraq. So got hooked up with a few more families, fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, whose loved one had been killed. So in January of 2005, we organized Gold Star Families for Peace. And then I didn't have a job. I was trying to network with as many people as I could to do anti-war events, to highlight the pain of losing somebody. I keep saying losing, but I don't like that euphemism. Having somebody murdered in the illegal and immoral war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I started speaking around the country. Organizations would invite me to speak. Just peace groups would invite me to speak. And I was traveling using Casey's insurance money that he had made me the beneficiary of. And I thought, what better way to use the insurance money than to try to stop the very thing that murdered him? And so I think the most significant thing I did, and I was starting to get on some media, I did Good Morning America from the inauguration, Bush's second inauguration in Washington, D.C. I went there to protest it. I was invited to go on Good Morning America. I was doing shows on MSNBC and CNN. and doing radio shows, mostly like I was starting to be interviewed by some of the shows on Air America, which was still a thing in 2004, 2005.
This was all before the Downing Street memo hearings?
Yeah. This is all before that.
Okay.
And so then on May 1st of that year, 2005, we found out that there was a memo called the Downing Street memo that was leaked. And somebody from Britain had come to the United States, and they were talking about the war in Iraq. And he went back to number 10 Downing Street and told Tony Blair at the time that that it was already a done deal, that the U.S. was going to invade Iraq. It was leaked in 2005, but it happened, obviously, in 2002, I think the meeting took place.
Right. They said that they were going to fix the facts around the policy.
Yeah, I was just about to say that because I'm the one that's being interviewed. So
I remember that it took a while for American media to even report on it.
And so anyway, we formulated, me and some other people I had been in contact with, like David Swanson and Kevin Zeese and some people from the Progressive Democrats of America, we kind of formed this thing called the Downing Street Coalition, and Gold Star Families for Peace was part of that. And so then on June 16th, 2005, I was invited by John Conyers, who was the ranking minority member of the House Judiciary Committee at the time, that he was having this hearing on the Downing Street memo. So I was invited to testify in Washington, D.C. Ray McGovern was invited to testify, the ex-CIA agent. John Bonifacio, who was a constitutional attorney from Boston, was invited to testify, and Joe
Wilson,
the ambassador who exposed the yellow cake uranium fraud. And so then that's when most people knew who I was, and, well, not most people, but, you know, people who pay attention to such things. And that's when I started to really feel the effects of being attacked by people like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and people like that, you know. So I was already on the radar screen before I went to Crawford, Texas, and August 6th was the first day of 2005. So that's about my activism. I was writing a lot of articles that were being published and things like Common Dreams and Truth Out. And this was all before the Downing Street memo hearings. I was just starting. I was published on many different anti-war and online journals. So I wasn't like unknown before the Downing Street memo hearings, and certainly not after when I went to Crawford.
Well, the Downing Street memo hearings is the first time that I had ever heard of you. And I remember I stayed home from work that day to watch because I thought, oh, my God, we're finally getting somewhere here, you know, and obviously nothing ever came of that. Now, when did you decide to go camp out in Crawford, Texas, and who named the camp?
Well, I want to say one more thing about the Downing Street memo hearings.
Sure.
Most of the people who reported on it at the time of June 16th, 2005, were saying it was old news because it happened, the meeting happened in 2002. The meeting happened in 2002, but you didn't report on it then. So it's actually really new news to many, many people, probably including the reporters. So, they just didn't want to report on it because most of the media were complicit in and sharing the lies like they were fact. And so anyway, I decided to go to Crawford, and it was actually August 3rd, 2005. And I'll never forget this. I was at home, and the very next day, that was a Wednesday of that year. The very next day, I was flying to Dallas to be one of the main speakers at the Veterans for Peace Convention. So that shows you that a lot of people knew who I was. So I was invited to go to Dallas and be one of the keynote speakers there, and the VFP, Veterans for Peace. And I was on my computer. I was doing some organizing. I don't exactly remember why I was on my computer, but I was on my computer a lot back then. And I had the news on, and George Bush was already on vacation, and he was at some event in Texas. And that day, 12 Marines from a Marine Reserve unit in Ohio were killed in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And George Bush was asked about it, and he said some blah, blah, blah stuff. But he's like, I just want to assure the families of the Marines and the families of all the fallen that their loved ones died for a noble cause. And so he was at a press conference. So I was waiting for one of the reporters to ask George Bush what noble cause was that. And nobody did. And so I had about 400 people on my email list at the time. And I started typing, and that was back in the days of emails when you sent out mass emails. And so I started typing this email, and some people still have it because they got it. I need to find a copy of it. But I was typing it out. I said, you know, George Bush just came on. He said Casey died for a noble cause. And none of the complicit media, or whatever I called them, asked him what noble cause. And then while I was typing the email, I was so outraged by George Bush saying Casey died for a noble cause, I started typing. My fingers started typing. You know what? Tomorrow I'm going to Dallas, Texas for the Veterans for Peace Convention. Saturday I'm going to rent a car. I don't even know where Crawford, Texas is, but I'm going to rent a car. And I'm going to drive to Crawford, Texas, and I have a voice. I'm going to ask George Bush what noble cause. And so I sent that email out, and then I went to Sacramento because I had an event in Sacramento. And so on the way to Sacramento, I called my sister Dee Dee Miller, and she was going to meet me at the VFP convention in Dallas. And I told her, I said, you know, after the convention, we're going to go to Crawford to ask George Bush what noble cause. And she's like, okay. And then I called somebody used to do publicity for Code Pink that I had worked with. And I told Andrea what was happening. And she got a copy of the email because she was on my email list. And I said, could you please send it out to your contacts? And so she said, okay. So she was the second call I made. And then when I got home from the meeting in Sacramento, my email had blown up. It had gone around the world. And I had hundreds of emails to people saying, yay, that's a great idea. Some people in the Veterans for Peace were saying, yeah, we're going to go with you. We're going to support you. And one of the emails I got was from Hadi Jawad, who was one of the founders of the Crawford Peace House.
Wow.
And so I didn't even really know there was a Crawford Peace House. And after I thought about it, I remembered that they did, like, they were famous for showing Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 in Crawford on the side of a barn or something like that. And so Hadi said, you know what, Cindy? That's a great idea. We're here for you. The Crawford Peace House is here. Whatever you need. Let's meet in Dallas while you're there. And so Friday, I did meet with Hadi and some other people from Texas, some other organizers, and some people from the Veterans for Peace. And we were talking about the action, and we decided we'd all meet at the Crawford Peace House. Then Hadi was giving us the logistics of how you get to the ranch and stuff, which was, like, priceless. We needed to know that information, right?
That's good to have.
So we'd all meet at the Crawford Peace House, and we'd drive to this place that was about a mile from the checkpoint of George Bush's ranch, maybe not even quite a mile. And then we'd park at the Triangle, which became Camp Casey 1, and we'd march from there up to the checkpoint and demand to meet with George Bush to ask him what noble cause. And so we were talking about all these logistics and stuff, and Hadi said, "Cindy, what are you going to do if he doesn't meet with you?" And I hadn't thought about it. I said, "You know what? I think I'll just, like, sit in the road and refuse to move until he meets with me." And Hadi said, the most prophetic words of that summer. He said, "Wow, that's an action." And it really turned into be an action. And so we did that. We did all that on Saturday. I had already sent out a press release saying I was going to do it on Saturday. We were going to found out that Crawford was about 2 hours to the south and west of Dallas. And so there was a bus there called it was some Veterans for Peace from Northern California. They drove the bus to Dallas, and it had a big impeach George Bush on the side of the bus. So we called it the impeachment bus. So they drove me to Crawford, but we caused quite to do at the VFP convention, because Saturday was their business meeting and they needed a quorum to be able to vote for all their business. And all the veterans wanted to go with me. And so they kind of, like, made it so they had the quorum. And so people from all over Texas met us at the Crawford Peace House. There were people from San Antonio, a lot of people from Austin, a lot of people from Houston. Amy Branham, who was a Gold Star mother, is a Gold Star mother, came up from Houston. And then, of course, Dee Dee was there. And we rode the bus to Crawford. There was about 80 of us the first day that marched up the road, and we got stopped about, I don't know, not very far away from where we started. The McClellan County police stopped us and said we had, like, they wanted us to march in the ditch. And the ditch, of course, is filled with rattlesnakes and long grass and all kinds of stuff. So I was marching, like, next to the road. So they stopped us and said we had violated their rules or whatever. And so I said, "Okay, fine. I'm just going to sit here and I'm not going to leave until George Bush meets with me." But there was, like, no shade. So we went back to our original space, the Triangle, which became Camp Casey 1, and that's where we decided to set up camp. And so that day there was some IVAW veterans, Iraq Veterans Against the War, with me, and one, Camilo Mejia, who refused to go back to Iraq, and he came home on leave and then refused to return because of all of the, you know, war crimes he witnessed and had to participate in. We were talking, and he said, "You know, every camp needs a name." So we were thinking, like, Camp Accountability, Camp Peace, whatever. And Camila looks at me and goes, "What about Camp Casey?" And so it was perfect. And that's why we named it Camp Casey. And so that's I think, answered that question.
Yep. You had met Bush prior to Camp Casey. What was that experience like?
Well, so it was another June 16th, right after Casey was killed. I remember June 16th because it's Dee Dee's birthday. And so June 16th was the Downing Street Minutes in 05. In 04, June 16th was a day that we were called by Army protocol for our area. And I guess our area covers Northern California, Oregon, and Washington State, and maybe like Idaho, that's right next to Washington and Oregon. Anyway, we were invited, what the protocol officer told us is we were invited to have a sit down with the president, and that the government would pay our airfare and our hotel, and they then the entire family could come. And so we agreed to go do that. And then we also agreed as a family, we had this meeting as a family. And I'm talking about my other children, Carly, Andrew, and Janie. They were like 18, 20, and 22, 23 at the time. That we would not use the time to express our doubts about the war, our opposition to the war and to George Bush, that we would use the little time we had with the president. We didn't know how it was going to go, you know, that we would use whatever time we had with George Bush to tell him what an amazing person Casey was. And so we were flown up to Seattle, Washington. The meeting was at Fort Irwin, I think. I think that's the name of it. But the meeting was up there. There was like 17 other families there that were invited to meet with George Bush. And he came in, he said he just wanted to extend the gratitude of a grateful nation to us. And so we brought pictures of Casey and we were saying, look at him, you know, this was not, you know, not just a number, not just a cannon fodder. He was a valuable member of our family. And so George Bush was shaking everybody's hand and he went up to Carly and he said something like he was sorry for her loss. And Carly goes, yeah, so are we. And he looked at her and goes, yeah, I bet you are. And then he would call me mom through the entire thing. And I was kind of upset with that because I thought it was very disrespectful. And just chatted a little bit. And then he was gone. Oh, what was funny about this entire thing was that before George Bush came in, John McCain came in. So John McCain was like the warm-up act for George Bush. And so John McCain was like 100 times more personable than George Bush was at that time. You know, he was saying, you know, that he understood because he was a soldier. So, I mean, he was in the military. So he was claiming he understood our you know, what we were going through. And I asked him if he would run for vice president with John Kerry. He's like, you know, is there anything I can do for you, Cindy? I said, yeah, can you run with John Kerry as his VP? Which, you know, at the time I was very politically naive. And John McCain said, Cindy, I'll do anything for you, but I won't do that. And so,
well, everybody thought that he was, like, anti-war because of his experience in the war.
Well, you know, he had spoken out against torture and a few things like that. But, of course, John Kerry wasn't even anti-war. He was just not Bush. That's what I was more, you know,
Jay McCain is one of the biggest war hawks there is.
Oh, he's crazy. And I've had many more experiences with John McCain after that time. Remember when I told you I was on Good Morning America in January of 2005?
Yeah.
It was during the inauguration. So usually they broadcast from New York, but this time they were broadcasting from the National Archives. And the Library of Congress. Sorry, the Library of Congress. And so when I was leaving, John McCain walked up. And I said, oh, hi, Senator. I met you at Fort Irwin. But I met you there, and my son was killing a rock, and he pretended like he remembered me. I don't really think he did. And I said, you know, now, since then, I've become very anti-war, and I'm speaking out against it, and that's why I was just on Good Morning America. And he goes, well, good for you. America needs people like you. And so later, I recounted that some way, or I wrote about it somehow. And after I became, you know, notorious or whatever, John McCain denied that he ever said that to me. And so after Camp Casey, when we were all in D.C. for that big protest in September of 2005, I met with John McCain. And I said, why are you lying about what you said to me? And he's like, I would never say anything like that. And so, anyway, that's my experience with John McCain. And, of course, since Camp Casey, as you know, I've become way more politically sophisticated than I was back then.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You've become educated. You no longer believe in the election process, to my knowledge.
Or the Democratic Party. They're just part of the problem.
Yeah, the election process in this country is absolutely corrupt, and people ask me, you know, what party do I belong to, and how can I belong to a party when I don't even believe in the election process?
Right. And there's, you're right, it's just so corrupt and so controlled.
Yep, absolutely. Now, when Camp Casey, when did the corporate news first start to give real attention to Camp Casey? Was it within days?
The first day.
Okay.
We had so much press there. It was crazy. And then it just, like, blew up. I learned that day, never put my own phone number on a press release, because I couldn't even keep my phone. I couldn't. Every time I hung up, my phone would ring. And while I was on the phone, I would hear more people calling in. It was just crazy. And so the day after I was on CNN, I was like just all over the place. And on Monday, that was Sunday, that was the first night, we only had 7 people spend the night with us. We didn't have any tents. We didn't have anything except an ice chest filled with water, which is essential in Texas, and some lawn chairs. And then we had like a 5-gallon paint bucket we were using as our bathroom. And so, Monday, I was practically by myself in Crawford. Nobody was there. Dee Dee had to leave to go back to work. She was working personnel at Kmart in Los Angeles at the time. There were some people at camp, but I went back to the Peace House to charge my phone and try to catch up on messages and stuff. And so I was literally on the floor of the Peace House talking on my phone, trying to write down the messages, but I couldn't even listen to my messages because as soon as I hung up, another press would call me. It was like freaking crazy. And I was going like nuts. And all of a sudden, 3 pink people walked into Crawford Peace House. It was Jody Evans, one of the founders of Code Pink, and Tiffany and Alicia, who came to help. And they took my phone, they took my pad of paper, and they started to organize everything. And I was never so relieved to see anybody in my entire life as those people who just came and said, oh, just give it to us. You don't know what you're doing. And so they started to schedule the interviews and things like that for me. So, I mean, that was just like absolutely a lifesaver when they showed up.
Right. Now, at the height of its popularity, how many people were at Camp Casey?
Well, the whole first summer was extremely popular, and we had a sign-in. We had a sign-in book, And we had a map of the United States where people could write their names, where they were from. And it got filled. It was a really big map of the United States, too. It got filled up, so we had to have a second one where people can sign in. But we figure in the month of August, we were there from the 6th to the 31st of August. So that's 25 days. We had about 17,000 people come to Camp Casey.
Wow.
But there were solidarity rallies and camps all over the world. So
America stands with Cindy. They had them in their windows.
Right. It was like the first night was so amazing because we were there. There was only seven of us. My phone was ringing off the hook. Luckily, we were like in a place where it wasn't really, we didn't get great service or it would have been even worse. But people were saying, we're lighting candles for you in our windows and we're, praying for you, we're whatever. And then donations started to come. Trucks of ice and water would show up. They made this fund that people could donate to a pizza parlor in Waco, Papa Rollo's Pizza, which is still in business and progressive. They would donate there, and every night Papa Rollo's would bring like 20 pizzas out to feed everybody. So it was just really just an amazing time. And then I think it was the first Sunday of the first week, not the first Sunday we were there. So it was the second Sunday we were there, but it was like the first full week. We were having an interfaith prayer service. You might know Rabbi Arthur Waskow from Philadelphia. He was there. A lot of clergy came to have an interfaith prayer service at Camp Casey. And we were doing that, and one of our neighbors shot a rifle. He shot a shotgun at us. And so we were like distressed about that, but he was just saying, I'm just so tired of having them there. You know, he goes like, I don't care. They're entitled to their beliefs or whatever, but I'm just tired of the people camping right down the road from me. And so his cousin donated for the rest of the summer an acre of land even closer to George Bush's ranch. So a lot of us moved there, and that became Camp Casey 2.
Did anything happen to the guy that took a shot at you?
No, it's Texas. He lied and said that he was shooting at something on his own property. So, yeah.
All right. Now, many celebrities came to Camp Casey to show their support. Please name some of them.
Well, I also want to say that there were a lot of celebrities there, but they were not the heart and soul of Camp Casey. The veterans, the family members who had, I was their worst nightmare. I was a mother whose child was killed, and that's what they were trying to prevent. There were activists. There were everybody, a lot of people came to Camp Casey that summer, and people who came and camped out, because a lot of people just came for the day or whatever, but people who came to camp out, they chipped in to help. They, did dishes, they cooked, they did security, they cleaned, and, so everybody had a job. And Anne Wright was like, I called her my Camp Casey Commandante because she like organized all of that stuff. And so some of the celebrities that came, the well-known people were Joan Baez, of course. She stayed for quite a while. She came when I had to leave when my mom had a stroke. And so she came to kind of keep the people rallied. And so she would give workshops about organizing and folk music and concerts and everything. So she stayed the longest. And Martin Sheen came the last Sunday we were there. Al Sharpton came the last Sunday that we were there. What's his name?
I was waiting for you to say him. Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo Mortensen, the hot guy.
Right.
He came, he just flew there from California and came and said hi to me and chatted for a few minutes and brought me some shirts and brought me some produce from California because he said the food in the middle of Texas must suck. And so, yeah, so Viggo came.
He kissed your hand.
Yes. And he dedicated a book to, a CD to Casey and I after that, which was very sweet. So I think that might be, Eve Ensler came. A lot of people know her as the creator of the Vagina Monologues. And she brought Jane Fonda's daughter, Vanessa Vadim, who was her daughter with Roger Vadim. And Eve had talked Oprah into letting her write an article about me for her magazine, you know, Oprah magazine. And Eve was like, she's like, I don't like this, but the condition was that we couldn't bash Bush in the article. She goes, but I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in you and where do you draw your strength from and things like that. So she was there for quite a while. I got pretty close to her. And so it was just really an amazing, stressful but wonderful time.
Now, what was it like to become a household name overnight?
Strange. Of course, despite what all the right-wingers were saying, this wasn't a well-funded or well-planned action. I told you I thought of it August 3rd, and we were camping there August 6th. And people always were saying how I was funded by George Soros, whatever. I haven't seen a penny from George Soros. But, of course, MoveOn came, and MoveOn is supported by George Soros. But I kicked MoveOn out like the last weekend because they were trying to get me to support a bill in Congress for, you know, get out of Iraq eventually. And it was like sponsored by Dennis Kucinich and Neil Abercrombie from Hawaii, Walter Jones and Ron Paul. And I was like, no, our demand is out of Iraq now. And we're not going to support anything for a phased, like, eventual withdrawal. It's a bad bill, and we don't support it. And so MoveOn left, and that was fine. But, so, what was I saying? What was the question?
Well, what was it like to become a household?
Oh. Night? It was really good in one way, because I was very happy that the message was getting out. You know, the message that we had been trying to break through to corporate media about for so long. But it was also like super stressful because the stupid media was trying to dig up like crap about me. And there's really no crap to dig up about me. And they were just like lying, like telling like bold-faced lies about me.
Yep.
And once a lie gets out there, it's really hard to correct. And so that was super stressful. And then I had like members of Gold Star Families for Peace that wanted me to resign because they wanted to take over the organization because they didn't like that I was getting all the attention. But at Camp Casey, there was so much media out there that everybody was kept busy with doing, especially Gold Star families and military families and veterans. There was so much opportunity for everybody to be, you know, interviewed and get their story out. And that's something that we were always cognizant about is like all the families whose children or brothers or sisters or whatever were killed. They want to tell the story of their loved one. And we were very, like, thrilled to provide that opportunity to people. But anyway, so they wanted to kick me out of the organization. They wanted to take over the organization. And I would just tell them, you don't even know what you're talking about because it's not, yeah, people know who I am, but people aren't attacking you. They're not trying to, they're not lying about you and your families.
Right.
You know, they're, that's all on me. And you know what? I can take it. And so if you want, you know, if you want to sacrifice as much as I have, because I spent all of Casey's insurance money doing this activism, my marriage ended because I was never home and my husband wanted me to be home more. And I was like, if you want to sacrifice all this stuff for this cause, then, you know, perhaps the attention you crave, but is a double-edged sword, will come to you.
Well,
you know, and how can I help if the media wants to talk to me?
Right. Well, what were some of the things that, like Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, they were all coming out against you. And as a matter of fact, the other day, I had somebody say to me that I don't like Cindy Sheehan because, you know what, she didn't actually raise her son.
Right.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is, you know, 10 years later.
Well, that was one of the first lies that I believe started on the Bill O'Reilly show. I don't think he ever said that, but there was another Gold Star mom in California, Dolores Kesterson, who went on Bill O'Reilly's show because I refused. Bill O'Reilly invited me a million times to be on his show, and I always refused. But she didn't raise her son. But doesn't mean she didn't have a good relationship with him, right? So we're thinking maybe people got confused and started equating her with me. But yeah, so, but I would always tell people, well, first of all, that's just absolute baloney. You know, I had Casey, I raised him. Casey has a brother and two sisters. I've been married to their dad for 20 something years. You know, I don't even know. You're just making that up out of whole cloth. There's like not one shred of truth to this accusation. But I would always say, even if that were true, how does that make this war right? How does that make anything I'm saying false?
Right. I remember when David Letterman had Bill O'Reilly on. And defended you to Bill O'Reilly. That was a great moment.
David Letterman goes, you know, Bill, I just don't agree with most of what you say or whatever. And I'm paraphrasing. But he goes, how in the name of God can you demonize a mother like Cindy Sheehan who lost her son in the war? And Bill O'Reilly just automatically said another lie. He goes, no one ever comes on my show and calls terrorists freedom fighters. Well, I've never been on his damn show. So maybe he was like saying nobody comes on his show. He didn't say Cindy Sheehan came on my show and said these things. You know, he just said nobody comes on his show and says that. So that's another lie. So people are thinking, Cindy Sheehan went on Bill O'Reilly and called, you know, terrorist freedom fighters. So
it's horrible what passes for truth in today's
media. And Glenn Beck was calling me a tragedy pimp. And Rush Limbaugh, in one very memorable slam, said that my story was based on false documents.
Right.
And that I was like that Bill Burkett guy who was saying that George Bush never showed up for the Texas National Guard. And I met Bill, by the way, and Bill was totally raked through the coals and his whole life was destroyed from this. And so how do you make up do they think I buried an empty coffin and just went through this whole play act of, you know, having a funeral for a son that never existed? You know, I mean, that was one of the crueler things that was said, my story was just like made up from false documents. I don't even know how that happens. And Ann Coulter was, you know, vicious to me. I just remember once Ann Coulter said something about my legs, that I shouldn't show my legs in public or whatever. And she was jealous because I have really, I actually have really nice legs. But she said somebody with legs like mine shouldn't wear shorts or whatever. Something really like inane and stupid. but she really was on a rampage against me. And Sean Hannity would always demonize me. But again, he would always ask me to be on his show. So one time, I think it was in 2007, I just got so tired of his assistant Lauren calling my assistant Tiffany that I just said, Tiffany, okay, tell Lauren that if Sean immediately calls me and apologizes for every crappy thing he said about me, I will go on his show, because I never thought Sean would do it. And so he did. And he goes, and I want you to be on my show because I want to give you a fair chance to answer this stuff. And so he flew me to New York City. I was on, he had a show called Hannity's America that didn't last very long on Fox, but I was his first guest. He was so excited about getting me as to be his guest. But I said, Sean, you also, he goes, okay, Cindy, I'll fly you to New York from wherever you are. You fly to New York. I'll fly your assistant there too. I'll put you up in a nice hotel and I'll fly you wherever you have to be the next day. I said, that's great, Sean, because the next day I'm going to Cuba. And so Fox News and Sean Hannity subsidized my first trip to Cuba.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's a good story, huh?
So what was Fort Qualls?
Fort Qualls happened either like at the end of the summer or the next time we went to Crawford. And at Thanksgiving of that same year, because I promised George Bush I'd go back to Crawford every time he went on vacation, you know, until he had the, you know, nerve to meet with me. But anyway, Gary Qual's son was killed in Iraq, and he lived in Crawford. And so he came to Camp Casey like the first Saturday, after the first week. So the second Saturday we were there, he came to Camp Casey and he confronted me and he said, I don't like you speaking for me, you know, as somebody, I support George Bush. I support the war. I said, I never claim to speak for anybody but myself, Gary, you know, so if you support George Bush and support the war, then maybe you should be, you know, speaking out about it. And so, so anyway, there were other Gold Star families there, and we said, why don't we just, like, forget all the stupid media right now, forget everything else, why don't we just go to the Peace House, and we'll find a quiet place, and we'll just sit and talk, you know? And so there was probably about five or six of us who went, and we did that, and we were drinking beer, we got a little tipsy, and by the end of the night, Gary, like, was all over me saying how much he loved me and everything. And so the next day, the very next day, he came, and he rode across for his son. We were inviting every, you know, family member whose child, or, you know, loved one was killed to put their a loved one's name on a cross to be at Camp Casey. And he did that. And so the very day, next day, he got like this right-wing DJ from this right-wing talk show host. I don't even remember his name. From Dallas to come to Crawford with him. And he like strode across the road because there was already some pro-Bush people. They were coming out to protest the protest. He strode across the road from them and ripped his son's cross out of Camp Casey, made a big deal out of it, and then, you know, became like my nemesis. And, you know, it was really hurtful to me because I thought we had like some kind of understanding. Why all of a sudden are you like this? And so, and every time I was going back to Crawford, he would email me to remind me that when he was in the army, he was a sharpshooter and he could shoot a cantaloupe from 1,000 feet. So I'd be like, does this mean you're going to like blow my head off, Gary? You know? So, they set up Fort Qualls as an opposition to Camp Casey. But, when I bought my property there after they made laws that we couldn't camp in the ditches and stuff, I bought my property, so I got to know more of the townspeople better. And one of the ladies we got to know, she told me that people in Crawford, most of the people in Crawford, at that point, this was about a year or so after the first Camp Casey, and when they saw my determination and I bought that property and I set up the camp there and cleaned up the property, and they were very impressed at how neat we kept the 5 acres that was Camp Casey. So anyway, this lady said, Cindy, you know, most of the people in town, even if we don't agree with you, we respect you because you have stayed firm to your beliefs, and nothing sways you, nothing stops you, you know, and so we respect you. And she said, but I want to tell you something. We all know that Gary Qualls took quite a bit of money to turn against you, and we have no respect for that man.
Do they know where the money came from?
One of the rich supporters of George Bush. Remember, I don't know if you remember the day that George Bush went to a fundraiser and had to drive by Camp Casey?
Yeah, I remember.
That's where he was going, to the rich supporter. And so they're pretty sure that that rich supporter paid Gary Qualls to all of a sudden be the anti-Cindy Sheehan.
Now, you spoke of the crosses that were put up along the side of the road. What happened one day when somebody decided to take their truck?
Well, every night I would go back, almost every night, I would go to the Crawford Peace House so I could write my blog and post it. Because every night I wrote about Camp Casey while I was there. And they had Wi-Fi so I could, you know, post it. I usually put it up on the Daily Kos, which I don't have a relationship with anymore. And then everybody would pick it up, you know, like Huffington Post. I would send it to Ariana. She would post it, blah, blah, blah. And so I was there. I was at the Crawford Peace House, and somebody, like, ran in and said, somebody just ran over the crosses. And this man put a pipe sticking out sideways from his truck and just literally drove by and mowed down all the crosses. And so they're saying that we don't support the troops because we're opposing the war, but this guy just came and destroyed the memorial we set up to the fallen troops.
That's just horrible. I remember when Karl Rove drove down while you guys were busy doing something, and he met, I think, with some of the pro war.
Yes.
While you guys were away, it's the people that were down there. Now, let me see, where are we in the questions? Oh, what was your Secret Service code name, and how did you find out about that?
That happened. We found out about it Christmas of 2006. So we were there for a protest, and we were at Camp Casey 3, which was a property I bought. And so we couldn't camp, we couldn't park on the side of the road because they made the Cindy Sheehan ordinances that were subsequently declared unconstitutional, because we would get arrested and we took this test case to the Texas Supreme Court. But anyway, so we would have to, it was the summer. It was the next summer. I'm sorry. I remembered it was really hot. And so it was the summer of 2006 before I had my surgery there. But anyway, we would have to take vans full of people from Camp Casey 3 to the checkpoint to protest. It was okay for us to protest. They couldn't say that they couldn't say we couldn't do that, but we just couldn't eat, we couldn't sleep, we couldn't set up tents or any kind of permanent structures. But as long as we had signs and kept moving, they were allowing us to protest. And so that one summer, I was having some really bad issues, female problem issues. So they would drive me out to the checkpoint and leave to go pick up some more people or take other people back. So this was like a shuttle that would, you know, go from the checkpoint back to Camp 3 and back to the checkpoint, back to Camp 3. So about every 45 minutes, I had to go back to camp to address the issues I was having. And so I went back and forth about five times that day. And finally, one of the women who had been there the whole time protesting, Diane, I forget her name, Diane came up to me and she said, "Cindy, this is the most exciting thing ever." And I said, "What?" She goes, "You have a Secret Service name." I'm like, "How do you know?" And she goes, "Because every time you drove up, they'd say the blah, blah, blah is here. And every time you left, they'd say the blah, blah, blah has left on their walkie-talkies." And so I was like, "Are you serious? Are you sure?" She goes, "Oh, I'm positive." And so my Secret Service name was the Tornado.
I love that.
I loved it too. I felt so, I just felt like, wow, I've become such a thorn in the side of this empire that I was given a Secret Service name. Now, I have subsequently spoken to Secret Service agents, and, you know, they're sworn and trained to protect the president, but they might not always like that person or, you know, respect that person. But some of them also felt it was their duty to protect me. So, and these are the good ones, you know. Some of them are just jackbooted thugs, but some I actually got to chat with. And one of them, well, I remember one time I was going to a speech George Bush was giving in one of the universities in Texas. And I asked the Secret Service agent in charge, I knew him, we always chatted, if he would get me in close enough so I can throw a shoe at George Bush. This was after the guy in Iraq. He just looked at me. He said, "Cindy, you're lucky I like you, because you could be like detained right now for even saying that to a Secret Service agent."
Well, we already talked about how Camp Casey affected your marriage. We talked about how you had to leave Camp Casey because your mother had a stroke. Now, on the opposite side of that kind of spectrum, on a more positive note, can you tell us something you have in abundance now that you didn't have at the time of Camp Casey? This was the surprise question.
I right. An abundance of that I didn't have. Well, it's kind of, everything's like kind of gone in cycles. You know, I went.
I think the four J's.
The four. Oh, well, grandchildren.
Yeah.
For sure. I have five grandchildren. But I was thinking more on an activist level that, you know, I have two passports that are filled with stamps. You know, I've been able to go around the world and meet so many amazing people and do so many amazing things since Camp Casey. But on a personal note, my first grandchild was born in May 16th, 2008. When I was in the middle of my campaign against Nancy Pelosi for Congress in San Francisco, and that's Jonah. And since May 16th, 2008, I've had my kids have presented me with four more. So now I have five grandchildren, and they ground me. They have, after Casey was killed, I never thought I would. You know, I liked life, and I love the work that I do. It's frustrating because, you know, it's been 10 years, but the wars are still going on. We have a Democrat president. He got the Nobel Peace Prize. He is just another warmonger, war criminal like the rest of them. It's frustrating. It's frustrating that the movement has practically died since the Democrats came back into power in 2006, 2007. But, you know, the grandkids, like, give me back joy. I never thought I'd have joy in my life. And so there, four of my grandkids are Jonah, Jovi, Jackson, and Jillian, and Joy. You know, I don't have a grandkid named Joy, but that's another J in my life. And then my son has a son named Cohen. So they give me so much joy, but they also give me more motivation to do what I do. Yep. I can't imagine passing on this world, this violent, environmentally compromised, unsustainable planet to my grandchildren. And so they give me a lot of motivation, but also something that I didn't have before Jonah was born, and that's balance. My whole life was like dedicated to this cause, and it made me sick. I told you in 06 I had to have surgery. I had to have two surgeries. I almost died. I almost bled to death. And that was because I was, not taking care of myself. And nobody else was letting me take care of myself. I couldn't even be sick. I couldn't say, I can't come to your event because I'm sick. And people would flip out. And so I was traveling all the time, sick and tired and whatever. And so now I have balance in my life. And it's so much easier to be an activist when you have that balance. So a lot of people ask me, like, what's your advice to activists? And I'm always like, find that balance in your life. The struggle will always be here. You can take time off. You can take a year off. And I guarantee when you come back, there will always be the struggle. Doesn't matter what struggle you're involved in, or perhaps there's a great victory and all the wars end. There's always going to be something that we can do to try and make the world a better place. So find balance in your life, but also like recognize burnout. And I've told you this, you need to take some time off, turn off your computer, go outside, get some fresh air, go to the gym, do whatever. Just recognize that in other activists and really avoid burnout. And try and not just tell other activists take time off, but say, what can I do to help you? Is there anything that you need right now that I can provide? I'll be happy to provide it. So so the grandkids and balance and just a lot of frustration I have in abundance, and a lot of anger I still have because people are still dying. They're still being tortured. Their countries are still being destroyed. It's hard to even think that we can live in a world like this when so many people are being killed by this evil empire that we live. And it's frustrating because now we're coming up with elections and people are saying, oh, this, candidate will, he's our savior or she's our savior. They'll fix everything. And so it's frustrating that people still believe that. And so, so there's good and there's good things and negative things, but I always say I wake up in the morning and the sun's out and I get out of bed and just go and do what I can.
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about, after the first Camp Casey, you left to go directly to Washington, D.C., correct?
No, we didn't go directly. We had, there was a big protest scheduled September 26th there. And so from Camp Casey, we sent out three RVs that went different routes to have rallies along the way. And we call it the Bring Them Home Now tour. And so I flew from, I didn't really stay on in the RVs because all the big cities wanted me to be there. So Philadelphia was one of the ones I went to on the tour, New York. We went on a lot of places during the tour. But also we went to New Orleans right after Katrina.
To
assess the situation there, because we had 5 tons of supplies, 10,000 pounds left of water, toilet paper, some food that wouldn't go bad, wouldn't spoil. And so we had that big impeachment bus I told you that I rode to Crawford in. Mm-hmm. And several trucks took our supplies that were left over from Camp Casey and drove to New Orleans. And we set up we were one of the first people in there with relief. And we set up like this relief center. And the people from Camp Casey were active in the relief efforts right after Katrina.
Well, the reason that I asked this question is because there's this myth that you stopped eventually doing what you were doing. But the fact of the matter is, since Camp Casey, you've never stopped. You've never stopped. You've always had some kind of action going.
Right.
And a lot of people need to know that because, you know, that's one of the lies of Cindy Sheehan. After Obama came into office, I saw several headlines that said, where is Cindy Sheehan?
Right.
Where is Cindy Sheehan? And you were camping out at Martha's Vineyard to protest Barack Obama. I think that was in the summer. You know, you were constantly doing something.
Right.
And, you know,
several camps in Washington, D.C., the bike ride from Tour de Peace from California to Washington, D.C., several books, many Cindy Sheehan soapbox, many, many actions. We've tried to, try to stop the wars. And it's just really difficult when these people, like some people who say, where's Cindy Sheehan, are actually journalists. And I'm like, what the hell? You don't have Google?
You're not that hard to find.
You know, you could just Google me and save yourself the embarrassment of asking where I've been.
Right. Now, as someone that has participated in several actions with you, I have seen how the corporate news greatly ignores you. Do you think that's because they don't want another Martin Luther King to inspire the people?
Well, I think that certainly is part of it, but of course they started to ignore me fairly soon after Camp Casey because a lot of them would say, you know, who's telling you what to say? You're so articulate, you're so knowledgeable. You know, Chris, what's his name, on MSNBC,
Chris Matthews.
I don't even watch TV anymore. He at Camp Casey, he's like, you should run for office. You sound smarter than everybody in Congress. And so I think the part was, it's okay to show a grieving mother because that's like something new. And to show a grieving mother who's against a president is kind of unique. But to constantly talk to this grieving mother and find out she's very intelligent, very articulate, she knows her facts, and I'm absolutely unflappable. You know, I can't be flapped. They can't dig up any dirt on me. And so that's different to have somebody on to challenge, because Anderson Cooper from CNN came to Camp Casey to do a hit piece on me because the first time he interviewed me, it was like remotely. And I said, Anderson Cooper, where were you? Why weren't you investigating what the government was saying, what George Bush and Dick Cheney and all those people were saying? Why didn't you investigate those lies? Why did you just report them like they were facts? And he says something like, well, there's only so much investigating we can do. I'm like, fail. The corporate media didn't do its job. You guys are one of the problems. And so Anderson like came out on a rampage and had Gary Qualls on, had all these people in opposition to me. And you know my sister Dee Dee.
Yep.
After Anderson Cooper came, she had to be restrained. She was going to kick his butt. And after he interviewed me, I just left. I left Camp Casey. I was so upset. He was not fair or balanced. And I was like, why didn't you investigate the war like you're investigating me?
Well, that reminds me.
I'm just a grieving mother. Why didn't you investigate the lies the frickin' president said?
It reminds me of a movie that I just watched with about Gary Webb called Kill the Messenger.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that yet.
That's an awesome movie, and
yeah,
it's exactly what the corporate news does.
Mm-hmm.
Every time there's somebody who comes out with a message against the empire, they automatically go right after the person and ignore the message that they're saying. And, you know, you're one of those people that they did that to. And I don't think that they would allow, the corporate news today would allow for someone like a Martin Luther King to come to be. And I've always thought that you could have been one of those people. They would not allow that to happen. And when you look at the corporate news today, I mean, watch how quickly people jump on things like the Ice Bucket Challenge.
Right. You know,
or Cecil the Lion.
Right.
It was tragedy, but, you know, there are other... How many people did we kill in the Middle East? Nobody seems to care about that. So it shows how much power the corporate news still has in this country, and it's a shame.
I don't think they're the ones with the power. They're just doing what they're told to do.
Maybe influenced.
By the people who... Yeah, they're influential. They're certainly very... Well, John, do you have any other questions?
Because
yeah, my voice is going away.
My last question is, what would you like to say to all of the people that came to Camp Casey and to all of the people that supported Camp Casey from all over the country?
Well, we, have what we call our Camp Casey family now, and we have lost some very dear members of our family. You know, of course, it's been 10 years, so, you know, people have died from disease and accident. So a lot of our dear family members have passed away, and I want to say that we always remember them with a lot of fondness. There was a core of people who came to every Camp Casey, and we're still in contact, and we were going to have a 10-year reunion this year, but my sister Dee Dee was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, so she and I couldn't make it. So it's like, well, if we can't have a reunion without Cindy, then we'll just postpone it until Dee Dee is cured and in remission. So I just want to say thank you to everybody who supported it. We just got a massive amount of support from around the world. But I also want to say, you know, electing a Democratic Congress in 2006 and electing a Democratic president in 2008 were not victories for the anti-war movement. It was more of a defeat for us, because the wars, like we pointed out, Obama's expanded started new ones, increased drone bombing, and of course the gap between the rich and the poor is growing because Obama's just another able servant of empire. And we just can't be anti-Republican war. We just can't be anti-Bush or anti-Republicans, because the Democrats are a profound and necessary part of the establishment and part of the war machine, because they demobilize movements. The Democrats not only demobilize the anti-war movement, they demobilize the Occupy movement. All of the major cities where Occupy was that were attacked, it was Democrat mayors who were Democrats. So, and of course, there are little organizations go in and undermine everything. But anyway, I just want to say that we need to be a peace movement. We need to be based on principles and not political parties, and to really join in those efforts to end the wars and not be so tied to partisan political buffoonery, because that's really what it is. I just would like the movement to mature to that, and to have the numbers we had in 2005, but not allow ourselves to be dissipated or dispersed or marginalized, to grow stronger and stronger and stronger to actually end this evil empire that we live under, because war is obviously not a situation that is exclusive to Republicans. We've been in more Democrat wars in the last 100 years than we have been started by Republicans. It's a systemic problem, and I just wish that everybody who was so supportive when Bush was president would just really mature and be the same way and continue because it's not just about Casey's life or the thousands of U.S. troops that were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's everybody on this planet. You know, we have the same existential right, and we need to care about them as much as we care about ourselves.
That's a wonderful note to end on. I want to thank you very much, Cindy, for taking the time today. I want to say that I love you, and I want to thank you for being the inspiration you were in 2005 and the inspiration that you continue to be for me and for a lot of other people.
And I want to say thank you, John, for agreeing to be the interviewer for Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we hope that you start producing your show for the People Soapbox Network and find some more interesting guests to present us with some We Were Lied To About 9/11 shows.
Thank you, dear. And this was my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.